Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcasts, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community.
Hello.
Start again. There you go.
Hello, and welcome to the Blue Marble Podcast, a program of the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast, CSNP. I'm your host, Reverend Charlotte Baer, Circle Sanctuary Minister and facilitator of the Green Faith Circle Ministry here at Circle Sanctuary that is committed to climate justice and eco-activism today. In 1972, the last Apollo mission took a photo of the Earth that showed the big picture of our water-based planet and our lives upon it. This image was named the Blue Marble, and it was the very first time that humankind had seen such a photograph of our planet home as a whole. This photo has become the iconic image for the Earth Day movement and the environmental movement since then. In 2022, the climate justice movement is the overarching environmental and social justice movement combined that is fighting for the planet and for the systemic, social, and economic changes needed now. The climate justice movement is global, multicultural, intergenerational, and interfaith. The Blue Marble podcast is focused on keeping the discussion going about this growing intersectional movement. And my hope is that no matter who you are, you will find these podcasts to be informational, helpful, and motivational. Today, my guest is Ben Baer. Ben Baer is a senior at California State University at Humboldt, and he is a major in environmental science, management, and policy. He's also a climate reality leader and has been involved with climate justice for a number of years now. He's also my son. And quite honestly, I asked him to join me in this conversation because he was home on holiday break through the Yuletide season. And we watched the blockbuster Don't Look Up. And we really found it interesting that sitting in our living room, we had the perspective that spanned the generations, starting with people who were there at the beginning of the Earth Day movement, all the way up to the climate justice movement today. And so we wanted to share a conversation about the impact of Don't Look Up and about perspectives from the generation X, Gen Y, and maybe Z about climate change. Ben, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation today.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. So, what about that Don't Look Up bombshell? I mean, that was an amazing film, wasn't it?
It just kind of put everything that I could ever want to say in the face of just the blind and the blind greed that we deal with today.
No, the blind greed we deal with today. You know, I realize I probably better say for the audience, in case someone hasn't seen it, Don't Look Up, which is a 2021 film. It's an American satirical science fiction film. It was written, produced, and directed by Adam McKay, who was at one time a senior writer for Saturday Night Live and has done directed several Will Ferrell movies and has a real interesting track record that way. And it stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, Meryl Streep, among just a star-studded cast. And it's about two astronomers attempting to warn humanity about an approaching comet that will destroy human civilization. It's an allegory for climate change. I think that's pretty apparent, although they didn't set out to make the film about that. It became that. And it's a satire of government and media indifference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can draw parallels with this from this movie with a lot of social issues happening today. The most prominent one seems to be climate change and how that's taken off And the producer, in an interview, even admitted that the original inspiration behind this premise was in terms of responding to climate change. And he was speaking to some peers about how to be able to deliver that message across. And someone drew the metaphor of it's like a comet hurtling to Earth and nobody cares. And then this kind of just over the course of years got conceptualized and became a movie, which then landed this last month and just in time for New Year's.
Yeah, and I know one wrinkle I thought was really interesting, there have been a number of reviews in The Atlantic and The Guardian and stuff, because I think I read that within the first week of release, this movie was in the top 10 film list in 94 countries.
Yeah.
And it's now like the most viewed film on Netflix ever. So, I mean, that's a pretty amazing audience reach within the first month of release, you know.
Yeah. And that shows that it really calls out to people. It really reaches people and speaks to a kind of, I would consider, underlying frustration, passion and panic that we don't get to really talk about on an everyday basis. And we're all very busy, all trying to just, you know, make ends meet and find the next step moving forward. And we're all in our own worlds trying to make our own way. And meanwhile, in the background of all of that is this just progression of events and disasters and crises and problems being continually exacerbated more and more and more every year. And we just continue living as though none of it's happening because we have to make ends meet, just living life as normal. And for a lot of people, especially as it's growing, the voice of this is growing on social media, a lot of people, this is starting to drive people a little crazy. It's starting to drive us a little mad because we all know things are not normal. And that just made the speech that complete like break that Leonardo DiCaprio's character had in the movie. Finally, when he just broke the character altogether, that resonated, I think, with so many people, because that's exactly what we all want to scream.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, and I mean, I was in reading about it too. It's like McKay and others in writing this, they said they started the concept of this back during the Bush-Cheney administration, right? So things were really different in the conversation at that point. And they thought that their portrayal of media and government indifference at that time was pretty far-fetched. But then as they watched the Trump administration come on, one quote I read was that he said, "The point at which we saw the president of the United States advising people to ingest bleach to fight a pandemic was the moment we looked at each other and we said, wow, you know, fact is far exceeding fiction here. We're going to have to really ramp up the fiction element of this because our satire isn't crazy enough." And so that's how they got to a lot of the scenarios they have in the film. Mm-hmm. Well, it says something about the power of humor in discussing this. And you are a very funny guy. So what's the value of irreverent humor, you think, or of satire?
Well, when you look at addressing conflict with people, whether you've practiced this in your own life or whether this has happened with you, but when you're wanting to be on the defensive, or when you're on the defensive, when someone can make you laugh, it lowers that an initial wall of deflection, of skepticism. It kind of lowers that bump by bump a bit. And when, and especially blending that with the power of a story that can draw parallels to modern day and real life and real issues happening today, and just using satire and humor. There are a lot of people that can feel under attack, but at the same time, there's a lot of just completely hilarious moments and dialogue all throughout a film, and it gets people to laugh and lower that guard. It's something that my friends have done with me, where if I have a good friend, and when he wants to kind of be real with me about certain issues that he might have with behaviors of mine, it makes me laugh and I crack up and he makes jokes out of like him asking these things of me. And it just totally puts me on the same page and just looking at it from an outside lens versus a place of defensiveness. And it's like, okay, we can move forward. And it communicates it in a way that doesn't attack the other person, but also calls out exactly what needs to be said. Because laughter brings people together. Laughter is is communal,
mm-hmm.
innately, mm-hmm. just as story is.
Mm-hmm. 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 So the impact of this film, ultimately, especially getting the kind of audience viewing, what's your sense of what the impact of this is going to be? Is it just going to be another blockbuster and people forget about it and like 2 months from now it's something else? Or do you think it's going to have a lasting impact? Do you think it made a difference?
It's really hard to say these days. So much of modern day social media and what I've witnessed within the various different age groups within Gen Z is that sensation and sensational media is really what news outlets and mass media goes for. It's what movies go for. It's what politicians go for now. It's sensationalism. And this movie was sensational for a lot of people, but nobody clings on to that sensation. It has its impact. It carries on for a bit, and then it passes. And then everybody wants the new sensation and the next sensation. And we just keep taking that in over and over again and leading to the next sensation. And that can also be damaging in terms of the delivery of a lot of a lot of news around climate change, because it's always amped up as the most groundbreaking record-breaking, weather events and everything. And people, that becomes the sensation of that loses meaning over time. And then they're going to change up their strategy and find something else to be sensation. And that can easily move past climate change. That can easily push this movie into the dust. And it denounces real dialogue around how normal the precedent that this movie makes an entire satire piece mm-hmm. out of, the mm-hmm. precedent that is happening today, and mm-hmm. why we need to understand this as and accept this as normal. Mm-hmm. This has become the new norm, and mm-hmm. it's not going to get better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I take away from the film is that our real challenge is in continually making political business leaders, our legislators, our business leaders, our politicians respond to demands. Yeah, I mean, it's a call mm-hmm. for even more constant democratization, exercising your voice, putting pressure on those people, because what is being made fun of here is not the comet event, but it's the response on the part of people who are in charge and are supposed to be watching our backs, who just basically are looking out for their own self-interest and not responding appropriately.
Yeah.
And so, that's interesting. I think about now when I got into environmentalism and how you're entering it now. I was there in the 70s at 72 when we talked about First Earth Day and the Earth Day movement, and starting with that whole inauguration of the real so-called environmental movement. And now, you for the last, since 2017 have really jumped in as a young adult, and you're right in the midst of the climate justice movement today. So that's from like 1970 to 2022. Can you help me understand what generations are involved in that span? I mean, I'm on the cusp between Boomer and Gen X. I'm right on the edge there, but who else is in that span of time?
Well, I mean, we have Gen X and Y, we have millennials, and we have Gen Z, and at least where I'm at, I kind of call it Gen because we're right on the end of millennials into the transition of Gen Z. But we people in my age group, we grew up in a kind of different culture than what Gen Z evolved into. Popular culture with Gen Z is different, completely different from what the social culture for people in my age group has been. It was at a time where we still had VHS, where we still had big block computers. We grew up with an entirely different genre of television. The seasons, for one, in terms of like climate change, the seasons existed, right? In San Jose, it would rain just about 75% of the entire winter. And we watched, you know, the BlackBerry phone at the time was the highest, you know, it was like the biggest tech advancement for the phone. Everybody had flip phones, getting that at around, you know, like high school, which was still considered pretty early for the time. And we watched, I remember seeing my first billboard for the iPad. I remember having my little, a tiny inch long MP3 player that had, and I had my own DVD player too, which was like kind of the hot thing, you know, back in elementary school. And it just, and all the awareness surrounding what's considered politically correct today didn't exist until I really started diving into about halfway through high school. None of that really existed. I still remember trying to process why, you know, people who were gay couldn't get married and how the government had control over that. It was a different time, and the whole kind of online sensational social media culture that Gen Z has now evolved into, that happened away from me and my peers and people in my grade as we continue to age.
Mm-hmm. So with those generations, there's a different relationship to nature. There's a different relationship to community, social spaces, cyberspace. Mm-hmm. And that very much we've seen in the last, well, I would say since 2010 especially, has really been affecting the way activism happens. There's a lot more emphasis placed on social media activism. It's considered now certainly as impactful as is doing in-person activism. Unheard of, you know, when I was first coming into activism, everything was about face-to-face meetings and one-on-one and community you know, town hall meetings and getting stories out in front of microphones. And you're lucky if you got a TV camera there, you know, it's media or a press release in the local paper. And everything was about, you know, marches and sit-ins, and it was all people, people, people. And those are very bonding kinds of experiences. They're wonderful community building experiences. Mm-hmm. Impact is questionable, sometimes great, sometimes not so much. How is that kind of a different experience than what happens on social media with social media activism?
Well, there's one really fun form of social media activism is what's referred to as a Twitter storm, because most politicians nowadays have a Twitter, and we just get millions of people all around the country to all tag these representatives and create a hashtag that will send them out, and it blows up the Twitter accounts of all these different politicians with literally millions of tweets that show unity and kind of solidarity and support for a particular legislative action. And in tangent with that, we also do a huge mass phone call. And so their office blows up with millions of phone calls, their social media blows up with millions of tweets, and then there's a new hashtag trending, and they're all being, and it all gets a bunch of retweets, a bunch of likes, a bunch of comments, and then it just creates an entire online conversation around it. And just, it's kind of in an instant happening one day, boom. So that's one example of that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my favorite app, and I'm saying app because I'm aware that apps are a new thing. Apps are a new thing. There are a lot of people older who still don't comprehend how does all this happen by touching an app, you know. But the Climate Action Now app that I really promote, and that Climate Reality also promotes, you know, has researched carefully, saying that the most effective social media today involves email, direct phone calls, and tweets. that those things have, you know, a lot of impact, that they've researched legislators and business leaders responding to those. So more than letters, more than in person, if you make direct phone calls, but if you do these tweet storms, as you're talking about, and if you do emails, those are all responded to equally with equal weight. So that's really interesting, because that never used to be the case.
Yeah, it's really a kind of the evolution of what is possible through activism. And and at the same time, there's increasing, I know that there's been increasing social anxiety and kind of increased, at least in Silicon Valley, where I grew up, increased social seclusion, with everybody kind of more clinging to their devices. And a lot of people, if they have to go out to a town hall and stand there for hours or chant for hours, they're not going to want to do that. But if you can give them something quick that will have equal weight, if they're passionate about it, they'll just hop on that immediately. So it's kind of a difference in what people are willing to do, the the efficacy, the self-efficacy of different types of action, and how that's evolved and how technology has allowed that to evolve.
So it's got to be pretty convenient. It's got to be pretty convenient.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you raise a point, which leads me to my next question of, do generational perspectives matter? I mean, I think we would say yes to that. And so my question is kind of how. I know that environmental activism, you know, it's not what my grandmother's activism was. It's not what my parents was. It's not what mine is today. I'm being schooled all the time by people in your generations about how to best do activism today. It's constantly moving and changing. So that's just some of the things you've been talking about, is, you know, how to speak truth to power is different. But do perspectives really matter in the climate justice movement, you think?
There are a lot of people who would argue that in terms of generational differences, that it's time to do away with perspectives, and that, you know, the older perspectives didn't get us anywhere. Older, the older way of doing things is what led to this kind of planetary destruction, and it's time that we take over. But there are many more people that understand that we can do this today. We have the privilege of being able to do this today because of the precedent that older generations and generations before us set. Everybody that gets into activism, everybody that gets into action and political action or social action, is doing it on the legacy of groundbreaking movements that made it possible, movements that even faced police brutality, that faced mass incarceration, imprisonment, who are still facing that today. Mm-hmm. And that set the precedent for activism moving forward. And we see this just happening on all levels. And those perspectives, those generational perspectives, do matter, because within that you have kind of a group that have profited off of mass disparity and exploitation, but also the groups that have been fighting this fight the longest. And they are the ones that set the tone and the precedent for new movements branching forward. And within then these generational perspectives, you have the development and the emergence of perspectives within those groups. For example, for a long time in the environmental movement, environmental justice wasn't really on the forefront for a lot of people, you know, largely advocating for the environment. They were advocating for preservation, conservation, protecting our open spaces, leaving wilderness untouched, and for keeping the beauty of the world, as well as avoiding the degradation of the natural world, and one of the perspectives that was left out of a lot of the decisions and the movement's actions beyond this was how that impacts impoverished communities and marginalized communities. And that's where environmental justice comes in, about how do we have an equitable transition that addresses environmental issues that deeply impact and disproportionately impact marginalized peoples around the world. because mm-hmm. it's not just about preserving the beauty of nature. It's not just about maintaining clean air and water, but then who gets access to that clean air and water? Where do the policies have the most weight? Where does the representation and the voices, who are they and who are heeded more? And so then it creates further disparity by leaving out those other perspectives. And then we have indigenous perspectives resurging too. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what I've really am enjoying. I'm really enjoying watching the climate justice movement fold in such diversity, seeing mm-hmm. in some unprecedented, and for every disappointment about not moving the needle far enough, fast enough, I also take hope when I see so many people coming together in unprecedented ways around systemic racism, systemic economic injustice, systemic misogyny, xenophobia, all of which are byproducts of or interrelated with the way we treat the planet and the climate crisis. I mean, the climate catastrophe yeah. now is affecting absolutely every mm-hmm. aspect of society, of Western civilization, of the way we live. And so none of these issues are mutually exclusive anymore. And so I just see this great diversity of voices, stories, and perspectives happening in the climate justice movement today. And that was not necessarily the case when I was first coming in.
Yeah.
To the environmental movement. It was more, I would say, more at that time, educated white people, you know, really. And you know, chops to those folks for taking a stand and all of that. But now to really see the movement diversify and hear so many more perspectives is incredibly refreshing and educational.
Yeah. And it was your generation that kind of helped push that and set that into motion, right? You set the steamroller off, and it's been developing and evolving over time. And so it's kind of been generational coalitionizing across historic divisions that are coming together.
Yeah, I hope they keep doing it. I hope they keep coming together because the mm-hmm. opposition in all of these isms, in all of these social and environmental justice movements, seem to be the same culprits. It's like what Don't Look Up points out. Follow the friggin' money. Just follow the money. Follow the money.
It's that intergenerational coalitionizing that for a lot of people who this just kind of guarantees the hopelessness that Don't Look Up communicates, is that that's the thing that the movement behind Look Up, uh-huh. the comments right up there and the whole thing behind that, that's what they didn't have. They didn't have like intergenerational coalitionizing and legacies. And unification in the movie. Everybody was kind of pushing their own agenda. Everybody was just fighting for sanity or in denial, and nobody could get anywhere. But the one thing that we have that they didn't have in the movie is we really have intergenerational legacies of people who have been fighting this fight for climate justice and real solutions and change on all levels in every sector, in every generation. And that terrifies, I think, that really scares a lot of these institutions and a lot of these conglomerates that profit off of the current status quo. And it puts also pressure and incentivizes further exploration of alternative ways of doing it that we can all move forward in together. And that's something that, you know, the Look Up movement and the movie didn't have at all.
Right.
And so this
it was
is
like
possible.
Last minute crisis. Yeah.
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 This is possible. And even if we can't stop a runaway, you know, even if we can't stop the impacts of climate change, we sure can mitigate it. And we have mm-hmm. an obligation to do so, because this mm-hmm. is the future of everybody else moving forward. And mm-hmm. we need to make sure that we do it justly, that doesn't leave anybody behind and doesn't, mm-hmm. you know, screw anyone over. Because if we do that, then it's the same type of exploitative process and institution, just under a different name.
Mm-hmm. So it's really calling for a game changer, a different, really a civilization change.
Yeah.
A civilization change. Now, I'm curious because you really got involved with the climate movement in 2017, I remember, when you chose to become a climate reality leader while in high school. Now, you'd been involved because you're in a family that's been doing climate action and environmental stuff. You were involved with a lot of environmental actions prior to that, but it kind of was part of your DNA growing up, and you took to it. It was absolutely natural for you to want to be engaged in fighting for the planet. And I'm just wondering, you know, what really got you involved with the climate movement at that time that made you want to do this? And what are some of the things you feel have been significant that you've had the chance to participate in since then?
The simple answer is I saw a 2-hour climate reality presentation, and that put into perspective a soul calling that I had been experiencing and having my entire life. And that put really a mission to it. I first learned about climate change when I was in elementary school. Mm-hmm. And before it became a whole controversy of what to change and what needs to change, it was like, okay, so that's a thing that's happening. You know, I was learning science in K-12. I was learning in elementary school. I learned the scientific method, and I was learning all about how that transpires and applying it through, you know, elementary's, you know, science projects. And it made me know, you know, when I heard about it, you know, if somebody at the time, if one of my peers had been like, oh, that's not real, I would have like, but you know, the scientific method, if they're saying it's real, it's because it's been tested and observed repeatedly by hundreds of scientists all around the world. Like, what do you mean? Do you believe in gravity? You know,
yeah.
it was so embedded that this entire, this entire way of being able to ask questions and seek truth within science, that was embedded as part of my education growing up. And that's one of the blessings that, you know, teaching science in elementary school, I think, did. Where it gets tricky is when it gets political. And when I started seeing pushback against that, I was really confused. And, you know, there's a quote, and it's from a video game, but it really stands true, where it says, if you want to make enemies in the world, try to change something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because whenever you try to change anything, you know, there's always going to be someone who is trying to push back against that. And right now, when I really start seeing the pushback from this change, I was like, wait, so clean air, clean water, clean technology, ending mass extinction, ending exploitation of marginalized peoples, and creating a habitable world and restoring balance to the earth. This is pissing a lot of people off. Okay, let's do something about that. You know, I was like, why is this so controversial? And then, you know, part of the journey was learning about how certain policies being advocated for are affecting other different types of people, where they can care about the environment all they want, but they need to be able to put food on the table. They need to be able to have jobs in the areas, and they depend on the very jobs that push closer and closer to this kind of climate catastrophe globally. Mm-hmm. And then there are a lot of policies being pushed towards where it's like, just we need to forget every other kind of social issue right now. This takes precedent. I don't care what your social issues are right now. This is about saving the world. We need to steamroll renewable energy as fast as we can. And for so many marginalized communities, they're like, whoa, wait a minute. And then there's a lot of, attempted exploitation by establishing that where they couldn't in communities, establishing that on tribal reservation land. And with the First Nations, who really wouldn't see any the benefits of any of this, and they're trying to steamroll this technology over there. And then, you know, they're like, hey, wait a minute. and so it's kind of been an exploration of what really excites me. It was that climate reality presentation that really kind of, I was seeing all these issues occur, and not knowing what to do, or what the kind of the binding agent, the root cause of all of this was. And the climate reality presentation made it as clear as day. Oh my gosh, it's climate change. and the institutions.
Let me interrupt you just a second. I'm sorry. No, thank you. I didn't want to derail you there. But when you say climate reality presentation, which one are you referring to specifically? You said there was a two-hour climate reality presentation. Or are you talking about the training you went to? Or are you talking about a presentation prior to that?
Yeah, it was a two-hour presentation prior to that. And that's what inspired me to pursue climate reality leadership, because I wanted to be on the other side of that presentation, doing the work, meeting people, engaging in action, and sharing that same kind of revolutionary or, you know, life-changing presentation that I had for myself with others. And maybe that will inspire others to take action too. Mm-hmm. So that's mm-hmm. what set me down that course.
In Silicon Valley, you were involved in some things, but you were also involved with the Sunrise Movement a little bit during this last election while you were up in college. Do you feel like you were able to participate in anything of a climate justice nature doing that?
Yeah, my relationship with Sunrise was a bit strained, because I joined the Bay Area chapter, and then I joined that before I headed back off to college. And so I wasn't able to get involved in a lot of the actions with the Bay Area chapter, because they were all in person. And I found myself, when I went back, I started becoming an RA, taking on a total, a full job, along with one of the most grueling years I had in my college experience so far. And I found myself really limited.
Yeah, but you were also involved in a lot of media support for them. I mentioned them only because they were focused on your particular Gen E group mm-hmm. of people coming into the now registered voter group as the youngest generation, and you guys were really, really pushing the Jobs Act and what's essentially the Green New Deal and a lot of these things that have been associated with young adults, or the younger generation now of young adult activists in the climate movement.
Yeah. So where I'm getting with all of that is engaging with them was trying and difficult, but when there was a lot more remote actions available and they started mm-hmm. being able to adjust campaigns for long distance, so that definitely the pandemic incentivized that. That's when my engagement with Sunrise really began. And it was primarily around the American Jobs Plan, the American Jobs Plan and the people's like jobs campaign, and making sure and trying to really push for a wave of sustainable green jobs that provide living wages for people. And especially when it came to the election, I was all over that. I was helping with phone banking. I was reaching out to people. I was creating election parties. I was partaking mm-hmm. in Twitter storms, and I really became part of the movement through that, mm-hmm. pushing through the election, mm-hmm. Through political campaigns. And it was a wild ride, because we really did a lot of good. We really made a lot of impact, and we reached a lot of audience in Gen Z and millennials. And we got responses and even meetings with elected officials following mm-hmm. that. And I got mm-hmm. to be as part of the actions team, helping to update contact lists and make flyers, make projections, and discuss in the planning meetings about what we wanted to do and what strategies to go for. And it was really invigorating and exciting. And they do such amazing work over there.
Do you find that there's much climate denial going on among younger generations? Is that really kind of an older generation perspective thing? What have you found?
I mean, yes and no. I do. I know a couple peers right now in my major who are in denial of climate change. But it's really the climate change denial is increasingly becoming more polarized, but mm-hmm. the acceptance of climate change is becoming far more normalized, and just the opposition is becoming more polarized. The biggest issue that we have moving forward is that it's happening and we're screwed. There's nothing we can do. It's already too late. We can't meet the IPCC deadlines that they've set. We're not going to be it. Our economy can't sustain such rapid transition. And no one has the political will to do it. So everybody's just kind of like, all right, this is the way it's going to be. And so really motivating people, trying to convince people that climate change is happening should not be the focus anymore. That should not be the priority focus anymore. It should really be about the self-efficacy of being able to make a difference and really pushing for not trying to stop climate change, but mitigate it. We can still mitigate it, and we should. Yeah. And if it can help us and help generations to come, we have a responsibility to do that. And it is possible if we mobilize, if we have the political will. And so it's about really driving that political will and social motivation forward. That's where the focus needs to be.
I agree with you, because from my perspective also, I would say that one of my mentors, Al Gore, always said is, you know, nature has the loudest voice in the room. I mean, you can deny all you want, but just take a look around. I mean, the difference is that when I first entered the Earth Day movement, environmental movement, we spent a lot of our time forecasting potential climate apocalypse. And what we are all doing now is spending a lot of time looking at the daily news, seeing impacts that start to look like a climate apocalypse isn't materializing. I mean, it's a really different reality because of the way the planet is responding to us just over hundreds of years now treating our atmosphere like an open sewer. I mean, it's just finally really manifesting, and in ways the scientists have said it would for the entire period of time that I've been involved. It's like, wow, the scientists were right. As Greta Thunberg is always saying, just listen to the science.
Mm-hmm.
They're telling us. And of course, that's Don't Look Up. Two astronomers are just doing their best to give the science, and it just gets derailed and mismessaged all over the place, which is so much of the frustration. And I love the moment at which Leonardo DiCaprio is appearing on what appears to be a Sesame Street program. And one little girl goes, hey, you know, they're doing that. And he goes, yeah, well, you know, a comet's going to kill the planet. Everyone's going to die. And she goes, oh, I don't like this guy. He doesn't make me feel good. And he comes running at the screen and says, well, what you need to tell your parents is that, I forget what it is. This administration are fascists and psychopaths or something like that. And he's screaming.
It was
at
something
the camera.
Like that. Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. But it's like, yeah. So yeah.
It's like, well, you shouldn't like that.
Yeah, that should be hard to deal with. You shouldn't like that. But the biggest difference in that worldview is what was being forecast and predicted, we're seeing signs of things manifesting. And I hear you, because if despair sets in, it's people feeling like we are hopeless now, helpless to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true. We're maybe not able to stop the whole thing from happening, but we still, with action now, can be doing a lot to mitigate.
Yeah.
To mitigate. So mm-hmm. How can we be messaging solutions about mitigation? That's really the focus I'm seeing. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. And really finding a way to really make people believe that their efforts, their time and energy amidst their already busy schedules is actually going to make a difference. Because the two leading issues right now that I have seen that I've been learning through my course in environmental science and management, and that I've been experiencing in the activist spheres and my social spheres, is that even if I do this, what's going to change? And is it even possible to change? I have to correct so many people all the time about, you know, when they say, yeah, we're just screwed. I mean, there's nothing we can do. I'm like, you're wrong. You're so wrong. I'm like, you can do something, you know, and I'm always correcting people about that and trying to inspire them. And I can even sometimes get belligerent because it's just so frustrating, this overwhelming pessimism and just accepted despair. And that's the last thing we need right now. And that's really that is the last thing we need to be fostering in an environmental movement. And that certainly, especially in terms of spirituality, is not the messages that I receive, and not the a calling. That the calling isn't, you know, it's not like, hey, we're suffering, everything's going bad, good luck. You know, it's like, do something. Do something. It's a calling from the core. It's do something.
I want to pivot and start asking you about that. But before we go there, I'm thinking this may be where younger generations like yourselves who are innovative and energized and at the same time dealing with the ambivalence of despair and motivation at the same time, this is maybe where you can get some mojo from the boomer Gen Xers who we used to talk about fighting the good fight and whether or not you win. It's about who you are. And it's like you're going to go down because it's about standing. It's about standing for what you believe and who you are and what kind of human being you are and believing that every action on the part of every single person will make a difference cumulatively. Every way you exercise your voice, your vote with your dollar, ballot box, whatever, cumulatively does make a difference. And there was a profound belief in that.
In every other social movement that's been led with the women's rights movement, with the civil rights movement, with the American Indian movement, with everything. We see that time and time again, and we're always having to convince people that that's the case.
And that hasn't gone away. But no. With respect to time, I do want to get to this because for our our listening audience, Ben is someone who was able to grow up being openly pagan all his life. He's been able to embrace his Celtic and Norse roots all his life.
In my family.
And so he's in, well, yes. Thank you. And with discretion in our different social spheres. But so you are in my mind, you are a pagan young adult activist. And something about a calling. Did you feel a spiritual calling from someone about this? Was it something that just came up in yourself and you decide you want to do it? Or do you feel there was a deity or a spiritual force that was calling this up and out of you?
I mean, it was kind of a calling off throughout my life, but never being able to know exactly what to do. But when I really started strongly cultivating my spiritual relation with the earth, with spirit, and with the deities that I would begin to devote myself to, there were those that that called to me in particular, and the call was strong, powerful, terrifying, and demanding. It was demanding. It was very much communicating the need to be ready, to be prepared, and to have the courage and initiative enough to be part of the solution. And I think I've kind of had an existential crisis since middle school, where I've been struggling to navigate exactly how to do that. And I'm still navigating that. And it comes from that fostered connection and that awareness and attunement to what's going on.
And similarly too, we've shared a lot around shamanic journeys, and I know when you and I've gone places and we felt the land spirits, you know, in our dreams, and wow, there's an expression, or they're pissed, or we're really tuned in. And also working with specific deities who are calling out that spiritual warriorship for the planet. And I think about, how my paganism informs me is not only a sense of connection and love for this planet and reverence for all life and the sacredness of all life, but it's also a call to warriorship. It's a warriorship call to stand up and be counted and to make my commitment to the earth count at this point. So, is that kind of like what you're talking about too?
Yeah. Part of the journey is finding strength and cultivating, either cultivating that warriorhood or cultivating that healing relationship with those around you and with your. There's a lot of need for warriors and healing right now. Mm-hmm. Warriors and healing
and storytellers like movie makers. And comedians.
So it would seem.
I mean, Well, what would you most want young adults to do, and then maybe pagan young adult colleagues to do? What would you want to say to them? What would you want them to do?
Well, for other young adults, really, your action does make a difference. This is just factual at this point. This is historical. Look at every movement that has ever happened, that has ever led to massive social and political change. And then look at this movement, climate justice, environmental justice, indigenous justice. Look at these movements, and they are the same. And we have a responsibility to our planet, to our collective soul in humanity, to our place in this world, and a responsibility to generations to come, and every other species that we share this planet with. We have a responsibility to do something, because there is no planet B. And we can look for that all we want, but if we have the technology and capability of completely terraforming an entire other planet to be able to support human life, we can also save this planet. And that should be on the equal playing field. That should be equal on the playing field and on the battlefield. So please, please take up the good fight, and please, for everything that you might hold sacred, fight for this planet. Even if it's not a lot, fight for it, please. Because I promise you, there are millions of other people fighting it with you.
That was very emotional. I didn't mean to cut you off there. I was thinking too, you know, you're a heathen college.
Yeah.
Your age. I mean, there's a lot there with in that pantheon about, you know, this kind of energy. Is there something that you feel in that tribe that informs your activism?
I mean, for those of us that know, the calling has been reaching more people. The calling is becoming louder and louder, and there's a reason for it. There is a reason for that calling. There is a reason heritage, gods, and spirit are calling people to the path, from Celtic to Norse and to every pagan faith. There is a sweeping calling taking place, and there is a reason for it. Reclaim your roots. And really, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of stuff going around about, especially on social media, where there's a lot of different magical and pagan practices or ways that you can do things or experimentations about doing things that are not grounded in real kind of traditional and passed down spiritual discipline. And I really recommend people seek out real teachers of grounded spiritual discipline and wisdom in that path, and cultivate that connection and let that guide you. Because if you are taking on the call, as we covered earlier, there's a call for healing, there's a call for warriors, and there's a reason you are receiving the call. So please, please heed that call. Have faith. The good fight.
Thank you. And for people in the Circle Sanctuary community as well, our Green Faith Ministry is devoted to that. It's through the Facebook page, which is a private Facebook page, the monthly meetings, the programs we're going to, really start to put out there now. It's all about keeping the conversation going, helping people to connect the dots, helping you to understand climate impact solutions, ways to be involved. So within this faith community network, there is a source, a place where people can go. Can always reach out to me, Reverend Charlotte Bear, if you're interested in that, and get involved in that tribe within the tribe as well. Mm-hmm. Before we go, Ben, I'm really wondering, you talked a lot about this battle against despair and fighting the good fight. For you, personally, as you, as we leave the don't look up, and we're looking up and we're looking out and we're setting resolutions for the new year and sort of entering in bulk, which is all about that new life within us. What are your hopes, say too, when it comes to the planet, the plight of the planet? What are some of your hopes for this year?
That we just have the political will and the spiritual will to make the change. And it's going to come with coalition and solidarity, the resurgence of, claim your faith, let that guide you. There's a surging support and voice and representation of pagan voices, of indigenous voices, the oldest stewards and caretakers and warriors of this planet. And there's the resurgence of warriors and healers that know that there's a different way to do things. My biggest hopes is that we can find solidarity and coalition and one another. We can take the necessary steps through humility to bridge divide and muster an indomitable political and spiritual and moral will to do what needs to be done and to be the change we wish to see and to get off our butts.
So show up, be engaged, and be a part of coalitions that are developing, especially tagged as green faith, multi-faith, and climate justice coalitions
and
that are really
and
environmental justice and climate justice issues that are very intentionally intersectional, working on these larger issues, not as things that are mutually exclusive, but are things that are converging together and need a big push moving forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ben,
what are your
thank you
hopes?
So much for your time. My hopes are similar. I'm hoping that we don't try to do what the leaders in Don't Look Up tried to do, which is rely entirely on the technology of billionaires to somehow save this planet and move to terraform another planet, that we understand the wisdom of the earth itself. And as you say, of the oldest earth defenders of our species on the planet, that we have the humility to bring forward the best of ancient wisdom with the best of postmodern technology and understand how to synthesize the two together into a new way forward. I continue to hope for, I guess my basic faith is in transformation. And transformation is often a painful process. You have to see things break down before you can break through. And sometimes things have to break down pretty badly before we start to break through. And nothing changes if people don't acknowledge the need for change. And it will be forced upon us if we don't accept it proactively. So we have time now to be proactive about how we'd like to navigate change forward. And so that's my hope, is that we will use this time we have so that we can be proactive.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me again.
I'm glad we had this conversation together. And thank you again to our listeners for tuning in. Please join us again for future Blue Marble podcasts. And with that, this is Charlotte Bear in the Monterey Bay, the traditional lands of the Ohlone Rumzin people, signing off.
Earth, my body, water, my blood, air, my breath, and fire, my spirit. my blood, air my breath, and fire my spirit.
Thank you for joining us on the Circle Sanctuary Network podcasts, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow the Nature Center paths. Join us here throughout the week for various programming connecting the community around the world. And please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSNpodcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites, such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. And until next time, many blessings.